This is Abby, and you are listening to Upzoned. Got my bus pass, been a ride, first class streetcar downtown, where the fine ladies and the peeps are. OG said, don't hurt nobody. Looking this damn clean, got my fit on. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Upzoned, a show where we take a big story from the news each week that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Abby Newsham, a planner in Kansas City, and today I am joined by Chuck Marone, author and founder of Strong Towns. You're about to be a two-time author, which is very exciting. Or, you know, you're an author of many things, but your second book is coming out, which is very exciting.
I hate to correct you right off the top, but this will be book number three. So the first book was Strong Towns, Bottom Up Revolution. Second book is Confessions of a Recovering Engineer, Escaping the Housing Trap, April 23rd. That'll be book number three.
Thank you. You're
yeah,
right.
It's okay. The plan is to do five.
There's five, yeah.
In this series. Yeah. And so this is, I'm halfway. I mean, over halfway. This is a halfway mark. And then I'll retire and then I'll go away and I'll never hear from you again.
But yeah, you can just go out in the woods and buy yourself a cabin, go in the woods with your dog and just disappear.
Yeah. So maybe I'll hurry faster. No, this is number three, and it's all about housing. And Daniel Hergis and I co-wrote this book. So the two of us put this together. And yeah, it's been, you know, you turn in a manuscript. And in our case, we turned in the manuscript in October. They give you a couple other like opportunities to do tiny tweaks to it. And then you lose all control of it. Like it's gone. It just kind of disappears into the publishing vortex. And they've been doing all the stuff that publishers do to, you know, format it, get it printed, get it distributed, do all that. But yeah, this week I went to the door and I had a package and it was my box of 20 books. They send you, it's a cool thing. And who knows if this is actually true or not, but I think it's true. I mean, this is what they tell you. The first 20 books off the press get sent to me. So I have the first 20 books for each of the books. And, you know, I put like in my kids' boxes of stuff, you know, so they'll have it someday. I write a little thing in there. And, you know, I give them to my mom, that kind of thing. But yeah, I got that this week. So they're printed. They're at the distributor. They've been sent out to bookstores. They can't sell it until the 23rd. We did get permission because I'm going to be speaking at a housing conference in Boise on the 22nd. We did get permission to sell them at the conference on the 22nd. So if you absolutely have to have it a day early, you can come to either my house and I will, you know, negotiate with you over my 10 of the 20 copies.
We'll post your address in the show.
Yeah, thank you. Or you can come to Boise to the conference I'm speaking at, strongtowns.org/events. And they will have lots of them there and they'll be at market prices and I will sign it and it'll be very happy.
I feel like that is a good transition to this article because you mentioned market prices, which is what we're talking about today for housing. So we're talking about an article that was published in Politico by Josh Cisco. It's entitled DOJ Escalates Price Fixing Probe on Housing Market. So the U.S. Justice Department is opening a criminal investigation into a major software company that's called RealPage. It's being described in the lawsuit as the big tech company of rental housing. It provides software that is used by landlords, typically really large holders of rental property, to estimate supply and demand for their listings in order to help them maximize rents. So the DOJ is looking into the possibility that it is facilitating algorithmic price fixing for some of the largest residential property owners and management firms. The class action lists a bunch of large owners and operators of apartments as defendants, including Graystar Real Estate Partners, Lincoln Property, and Cushman & Wakefield-owned Pinnacle Property Management Services. So this is apparently one of many probes into corruption issues in the rental housing industry by the Department of Justice to crack down on anti-competitive activity that may be driving up rent prices, including it going as far as to allege that landlords and RealPage have been actively colluding to artificially raise rents and participating in centralized anti-competitive schemes. The DC Attorney General, Brian Schwalb, he actually amounted this to, he said, he called this a housing cartel, which is really.
No, I love it.
Yeah, because you've been saying, you know, a housing trap, and I'm like, man, that's a good term. It's a housing cartel because it kind of is this like housing industrial complex. So this is one of those articles that I think, you know, you're reading it and it makes you mad to when you're reading it. And I, of course, have an emotional reaction to it. And I feel like it's either way overstating the impact of the algorithmic price fixing, or it's uncovering a very serious issue that is like the major culprit of our rental housing price crisis, or one of them at least. And it's something that I haven't really considered before. And I think I kind of want to take a moment to ask this question, and it may sound like it's obvious, but like, where do prices even come from? If not, you know, being like, if it weren't for these apps and outsourcing and trying to get market data before the internet, where are housing prices coming from? How are people determining rents? And then how do these programs completely change that dynamic?
That's a beautiful question. It actually is a beautiful question because it gets to the essence of how markets are created and what we know and what, you know, efficient markets are. If you think about times when you've sold a house, or, you know, because I know you went through that. I also think, have you ever sold anything like on eBay or Marketplace or Craigslist or whatever? Like, have you ever done that, or you've sold something?
Oh, yeah. I have something listed on Marketplace right now. And Chuck, I'm in the market buying a house right now, and I sold a house last year. So, you know, just experiencing that on both sides, it is kind of interesting to wonder where these prices actually come from.
So my wife has forced us on a couple occasions to have garage sales. And I look at garage sales as like, this is your opportunity to not throw things away and to let other people who could use them have it. For some reason, my wife has like a dollar amount thing. Like, if we do all this, we can make $100. And I'm like, if we can work for 2 days straight, we can make $100. Like, I'm not, to me, like, if you want my stuff, like, here's the stuff I'm not using, come and have it. And we have this like tension over it. How much should, you know, this like camping gear thing that we now have another one, so we don't use anymore. How much should that sell for? How much should this, you know, this thing that the girls use when they were little, but they don't use anymore, how much should that be worth? And the reality is that in that like garage sale transaction, there is what it's worth to me to part with it. And it's what it's worth to the other person to purchase it, right? And oftentimes when I'm doing it, I wind up like really, my wife says, you're horrible at pricing. I underprice things because to me, like the value is like, I want this gone. Like, I don't want it here. I want it gone. One time I had like a fluorescent light, like a halogen light that was like a construction light. And I had paid, I don't know, like $80 for it. It took up a lot of room. I wasn't using it. I hadn't used it for like 5 years. I really just wanted it out of my basement. And I put it out and I put like $15 on it. And it was the first thing to sell. And my wife was like, see, you sold this at the wrong price. I think if I were trying to maximize the price, like I would treat it different, but that wasn't my motivation. Okay, let's go to housing. My grandfather, as I was growing up, my grandfather had a couple rental houses. And I remember going with him to these rental properties. This was very like low thing. I mean, my grandfather died with not much money. So this was not like he was Daddy Warbucks renting houses, but he had a couple. I don't know how he had them, but he had them. One of them was rented by a family that was one of my classmates. And I was friends with her. She was very nice. She was in my class. We sat by each other. We were actually pretty good friends for a long time. Her father died when she was in fourth grade. So I was in this like weird program in grade school. She was in that program with me. She sat next to me. I remember when her father died, it was really, really horrible. We would go over there and my grandpa would go help. Like, you know, this appliance wasn't working. We go fix it. We go over and paint some stuff. He would take care of this rental property. I think about him a lot and I think about that transaction a lot because he would talk a lot about helping them. And I don't want to say this was charity because it wasn't. I mean, they were paying rent and like, this is what a landlord does. But I always walked away from there thinking Kimberly's father had passed away. My grandfather was helping them because the dad was gone and like, who's going to do this work and that work? The mom was out working all the time, two kids in school. I remember going over there and helping and feeling like we were helping out, not that we were like renters collecting, you know, what was due to us for our capital that we had. I think about what it would have taken for my grandfather to raise the rent. And it would have taken him talking to this widow and explaining why the rent needed to go up. And I just knowing my grandfather, that would have been a hard conversation. If he had a long-term loan that let's say it was $200 a month back in those days or $400 a month that he had to pay and he was charging $500 a month in rent and making $100, for him to be like, you know, I look around, the market price is now $550 or $600 or $700. So I'm just going to raise your rent because that's what the market will bear. My grandfather would have had a hard time doing that. And I'm not saying he was like this super massively moral person, but the social friction of doing that would have been harder. So ask yourself, what was the market price? The market price, if you say, it's the price that the person was willing to rent it at and the price the person was willing to pay for it. My grandfather, in this instance, was willing to rent it at what was probably like below market value because of the other, let's just call it payment that he got in being kind to this family. And his reluctance to go through the pain, the expense of adjusting the rent upward. That benefit and that pain, that expense, don't show up in a transaction report, right? Like they're not factored in, but they are very human and they are part of what sets, you know, quote unquote, the market price. When you eliminate my grandfather, when you eliminate the one-to-one interaction, when you turn it into an algorithm, when you automate it through email and through other things, and then when you aggregate everybody else doing that into a few platforms, right away, the transaction cost for raising rent goes way, way down because there's no personal expense that you go through. You can take that a step further where you can then look around and say, okay, this isn't just a transaction between me and you. It's now one where I can look next door and see what they're charging, and I can look next door and see what they're charging, and I can look all over and see what they're charging. And if I raise it a little bit, what do you do? Well, you raise it a little bit too, and we both raise it. Like we can inch our way up to like a maximum value without impairing the market in any way. I think what the transition to efficient markets, if we want to call it that, what the transition to efficient markets does, particularly in a market where you have constrained supply, is it the market doesn't respond. It's still a market, but it's responding to something different than a market used to respond to. And you can say the market now has more perfect information about what prices people can afford to pay. And so prices are going up. I think it maybe has more information on what the market can bear, but it has less information on the human element of it. My grandfather had more information on the human element of it and less information on what like the market could bear price-wise, what competitors could pay. And those are just two. What we have done is we have shifted from one market feedback loop to another market feedback loop. The second one is very, very concerned about driving prices up as high as possible.
Yeah, that's wow.
Does that make sense?
There's so much there to respond to. I think that's exactly right, Chuck. I'm picturing your grandfather's properties, and it's probably a bunch of small scale buildings that are owned by a local person. And this is why I think the concept and implementation of incremental development, small scale, local ownership is very important. It's about a lot more than just having cute buildings in your neighborhood. There are real implications, and this concept of social friction is one of them. When you have corporate landlords that are owning large scale apartment buildings and then outsourcing how they're pricing and managing those buildings to e-commerce software companies, that's a huge problem. There's no social friction between the, you know, company and or the entity that is providing the apartments and the people who are buying or consuming the apartments. And I think the other thing that's important to note about these software companies is that they do maximize revenue rather than occupancy, which I think also contributes to housing supply and what people are, you know, able to get into. And that goes to kind of your story about garage sales, that there's this, you know, you as the seller, you just want it gone versus wanting to maximize price. And I think it's flipped in these terms, because these companies can afford to have a unit be vacant for a certain amount of time in order to reinforce their prices. They're not going to undercut each other necessarily. That's not in their best interest. So they very much are, you know, not necessarily trying to, you can charge a lot more at a lower or at a lower occupancy rate rather than trying to just have consistent occupancy at a lower price per month. And these softwares are really good at helping to maximize the revenue that these companies bring in.
I'm going back in our list of podcasts because it wasn't Kobe a couple of weeks ago. It was someone earlier than that. We talked about how development is financed. Remember when we had that conversation? You brought up the idea of like maximizing rents. It goes even a step deeper. The financing of the building requires a certain amount of rent, a certain level of rent that if you go below, it screws up your financing and actually pushes you into default. And so holding the line, even if the building sits empty or a unit sits empty, is important from a financing standpoint. Now, if you hold the line and I hold the line and the, you know, couple other like big property renters in the market hold the line, we can hold that line. And then the people who can't get in actually become a feature of the system instead of a flaw from a financing standpoint, because a little bit of scarcity is good. Let me say it this way, and I'm talking as a algorithm now, not as a human being. Keep the people who are going to be more trouble than they're worth out of my unit. Because part of running a unit is the transaction cost of people moving in and out and all that, and having to deal with tenants who don't pay and all that. If I can keep scarcity and keep the price high enough, I'm going to price out a lot of problematic people, and then I can just, you know, run my thing from an iPad and not have to talk to anybody. Like, it becomes very, very slick, very, very easy to do. The thing that is pernicious about this is if rents can go up, what that means is that the value of my building goes up. If the value of my building goes up, I can then go and take that capital and buy another building. And so I am always max leveraged. Like, I've always got the max amount of debt that I can, because that's how I make the most money renting properties. And so I have created a situation as the algorithm, as the landlord, as the owner of all this, where rents can only go in one direction. And once they move in that direction, there's massive amounts of resistance to them coming down. The Department of Justice and RealPage, you know, bringing this lawsuit against the company that like aggregates all this data, are they colluding? I think it's really interesting because, I mean, you can look at it and say, like, are they sharing information on prices? Obviously, yes, that's the whole benefit of the platform. Are they doing that in order to have prices go up? Obviously, the answer to that is yes. Like, I mean, that's why you use a thing like that. My grandpa didn't need something like that because it was a transaction between him and my friend's mom. If you're doing 1,000 units or 500 units or whatever it is, you need this because it's going to tell you what the market's going to pay and how high you can go. Are they using this to, in a sense, resist things that would push price down? And I think that that's where I would kind of draw the line. It's not like the airlines where, you know, one airline will lower prices and then everybody else has to do it. And then one airline will charge a baggage fee and everyone's else like, okay, now we'll charge baggage fees, because they're not really colluding, but they move in lockstep with each other. It would be as if the airlines operated that way, but once they instituted a price or instituted something, it could never come down because they all looked at each other and said, okay, it's in our best interest from a financing standpoint that this never comes down. And there's way, way more people who want to fly than we have seats. So we have zero pressure to actually go in that direction.
Right.
Is that collusion?
It kind of is. It kind of is. But I think the question that I don't have the answer to is it illegal? Like, is it illegal collusion? And that's what I'm looking forward to understanding as these lawsuits play out. Because the other thing that came to mind as I was reading this is, like, isn't price fixing basically the entire point of services like RealPage? Isn't that the entire point of e-commerce for lots of different industries? I'm thinking of like ride sharing or hotel pricing or vehicle pricing. They're all using algorithms. And at what point legally does something go from being, I guess, legal outsourcing of market data to a conspiracy to fix market prices? And I don't know what the answer to that is.
I feel like we're having this debate across many domains, right? Why is there not another Facebook? You know, I mean, you could say, well, TikTok is the next Facebook, but TikTok is like a different platform. Why in digital world are there winner take all systems? It's because the more data you aggregate, the more powerful you become, and the more benefit there is to migrating to your platform. And so for RealPage, you know, there can only be one or two of these management systems, because they will aggregate the most data and have the most information. And if you're going to start up a new one, you're just not going to be competitive with the one that has all the information and all the data. That is true across so many different domains. And it creates this kind of like winner take all system. I think, you know, if you look at, and let me make an argument that I've heard lots of people make, you know, if you look at RealPage and say, this is illegal price fixing and collusion, you would have to say the same thing about Amazon. You'd have to say the same thing about Google. You'd have to say the same thing about a lot of these platforms that are providing services that have no real competitor in the marketplace. I think maybe the difference with RealPage, they're not price fixing like advertising. They're price fixing like an actual product that people would consume, being, you know, a rental property. But I don't know. These lawsuits are often brought not to win. They are brought in order to affect a policy outcome. And in this case, you know, if I had to predict like what will happen, you know, at some point in the future, RealPage or a bunch of these defendants will either settle for a low dollar amount or settle with no payment, but they will agree to price a certain percentage of units at affordable rates, or to, you know, donate to this thing that will build a few affordable units. There'll be some like superficial thing that kind of genuflex towards the problem, but doesn't actually deal with the problem. I mean, that's how these things generally resolve themselves. That sounds very cynical, doesn't it?
It's very cynical, but you're probably not wrong. And what I think is challenging about the whole housing conversation, and maybe you may have some thoughts about this since you just wrote a book on housing, is the alternative to that is that people don't purchase the housing because it's cost too much, but that's not really something that's easy to do as a human being. It's really hard to like boycott housing as something that is a necessity. And that's the rub, right? It's you need housing. And so this isn't like apples are too expensive, so you're not going to buy them at the grocery store. And so
this is like demand all food goes, is too expensive, right?
Yeah, just like all food. Yeah. Actually, all food is too expensive. So let's, yeah, we can't just stop eating. So this isn't like a simple supply demand situation where, you know, demand can go down very easily and then prices decrease, especially when you also have these attached to this big financial product system that relies on people paying for what has been built. Construction costs are high, labor is high. These are getting massive amounts of, you know, there's a lot of debt that is hanging on these projects. So, the people who are building and managing them are relying on alleged price fixing in order to maintain these projects. And housing is weird in the supply demand equation. It's not necessarily people can't just not purchase it because it's too expensive. We all have different tolerance levels of how we manage, how we pay for housing, but it to me, it seems like something that you can't, it's not as my question is, to what extent do buyers in the market, renters and owners, have an influence on costs?
Well, I don't think they have very much at all. And that's because the system is not responsive to local ability to pay. It's responsive to what can be financed. And this is really I just did a podcast today that will run after ours runs about the tension that Strong Towns has with the YIMBY movement. And, you know, I break it down to basically two things. One is, the kind of, I think, extremist YIMBY viewpoint of total laissez-faire local, you know, regulation on what can be built where. And then combined with the kind of belief in centralized capital being part of the solution. I think when you combine those two things together, the ability to build anything you want, anywhere you want, at any time you want, with lots and lots of money flowing through a small number of hands, you get what Kobe talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is you've got 25 home builders who control 40% of the market or something like that.
And are using the same app to...
Using the same app to fix up prices. Right? So you wind up with a situation where the market is no longer people supplying housing and people purchasing housing. The market is people providing financing and people utilizing that financing and a trading in financial products. The byproduct of the financial trade is a 5-over-1 apartment building, a single family home, a rental apartment unit. It is that, but that is a byproduct of the financing. The financing is what is shaping the market, and the financing is what the pricing is sensitive to. What we need is we need the pricing to be sensitive to what people can afford. And it's not today in any way. And so, the tension we run into is that people can make housing dramatically unaffordable and you have to buy it because, like you say, you have to live somewhere. Like, everybody has to have shelter. It's not like you can choose to opt out of having housing. And so you have to pay whatever the market will deliver it at. But it's not a market for housing. It's a market for financial products. In the market that we have created, we like to think of like you renting a place as like you're the customer and your landlord is the person selling it. The reality is that your landlord is the product, and the person buying it is the person who's buying the commercial real estate product, that the paper that was created as part of that transaction. That's what's running the whole thing, and you're just incidental to it. You're like the given in the equation. Your ability to pay, your preferences, your supply, like all that stuff is like, doesn't really matter. It's incidental to the whole thing.
Yeah. It's very, very extractive.
Extractive.
And I think that's why, you know, the DOJ was saying that this, or the Attorney General was saying that this is a housing cartel. It's a housing trap. It's, you know, the housing industrial complex. It's all of these things because it isn't responsive to what people can actually pay. And I would include, you know, not just the developers and managers of large corporate real estate development to be kind of a part of this system, but there's also the construction costs are very, very high. And I think a lot of developers would say, well, this is what construction costs are, and it's very expensive to build anything. And so therefore, if we're going to build, it has to be luxury housing. It has, and I hear that a lot from local smaller developers even. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are between the connection between construction costs, materials, labor, management of construction, and how this plays into how housing is developed and then quote unquote sold, leased.
I'm glad you asked that question, because I get, sometimes I will have small developers even come to me and say, I love what you're saying, but I don't buy into the incremental because I can't do anything incremental. I have to do it huge. I have to make a big leap. I've got to do something because that's the only way. I got to have a whole bunch of units because otherwise I can't finance it. I can't afford it. I can't make it work. All the incremental costs are too great. And I hear that. And I recognize that that is the reality on the ground in a lot of places for a lot of people. I think the question is that upstream or downstream of price? I think that the unaffordability of every step of the chain is actually downstream of the insanity of the financing. And that if financing, if the financing of it was more anchored locally, not responsive to the macro economy, what, you know, how much is your house worth? Well, it depends on what the Fed pegs interest rates at next month. It depends on how many mortgage-backed securities the Treasury is going to buy. You know, like all these things that are not related to you set the price of housing. If housing was more anchored locally, the entire chain of delivery of housing would have to change. And this is where I think we can debate like efficient market hypothesis. I think what has happened is that we have made the market very efficient for the financing and the movement of capital. And we made it very inefficient for the delivery of the actual product that people are consuming. Because the product, again, is not the house, it's the paper. Like that's what we've made very efficient. It's efficient to move $20 million from here to here. It's efficient to do that. It's very inefficient to build the actual building. I think that that needs to flip. And I think that this is not something that can happen overnight, but I actually think we can get to a place where we can build things a lot more cheaply, a lot with a lot more innovation, with a lot lower price points, with a lot higher quality. I think we can do it when we have a more locally responsive chain of delivery. And I'll tell you this just right off the bat, land prices need to come way, way down. And land prices need to come way, way down, particularly in like high value neighborhoods, because it is literally like the financing and what people are building that drives up those values. We have this kind of stickiness. I've written about this a lot, and I get the YUMI people really angry at me when I talk about this. But if you allow a neighborhood of single family homes to be developed to 6-story condos, and you stagnate that neighborhood out, so it's a bunch of slumlords and a bunch of declining properties, what will happen is that you will invert the prices, the price structure so much, you'll actually increase the price of land and reduce the price of the stuff built on the land, that you will induce stagnation, you will induce slumlords, you will create a neighborhood artificially in decline, and you'll do it at the same time that land values go crazy. Because what happens is that everybody sits around and waits for the big payout. They become speculators and they wait for the big payout that's going to come with the buying up 4 single family homes and building the 6-story condo unit. If that land was actually priced to where the 4 single family homes were ultimately going to evolve to be 4 duplexes, the land prices would be cut by like 90%. And now you have a completely different conversation about what you're going to build on this property. We have created an overabundance of land that is easily developable, has water, sewer, streets, roads. Our cities are nothing but massive gaps between buildings. If we took the mindset of someone in 1924 instead of 2024, they would just see a denuded landscape with lots and lots of places where you could build stuff. We just see really expensive land. If the market became bottom-up responsive, I think we would reflect the fact that what we have done is we have built our way to no land value. And we would start to see that reflected in the price of the transactions.
The ability for sales to not happen with land and properties is amazing. I mean, I see things that just sit on the property for sit on the market for a very, very long time with astronomical prices. And again, it gets to that point of you're trying to get the highest price point. You're not necessarily trying to, move your property into the hands of somebody else.
Well, and if you're going to have a decade of zero interest rates, your cost of capital is really low. If you're going to have a property tax, your cost to hold it is really low. I wrote about this in Strong Towns in the first book. I kind of threw San Diego under the bus a little bit because I said San Diego is like the most disorienting city in the country to me, because you'll be going along a random street, like not even like, okay, like why I'm on this rando street somewhere, and it'll be single family home, single family home, single family home, 20-story, a complex, single family home, single family home. And you're like, why this? And the answer is because whoever owned that place got paid. Whoever owned that single family home got paid. One. Two, the regulatory environment, that person like knew who to talk to at City Hall or like how to get the process done. And then three, they threw a massive amount of capital at whoever that developer was. It's not that the neighborhood was ready for that, or that was like the natural thing, or like that's what the local supply and demand of the market created. That is purely a financial product. It's purely a financial transaction. And, it is what makes markets like San Diego just bizarre. It just makes them berserk. Like you don't actually have local supply demand feedback loops. You have large capital flows.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder about all kinds of different industries. Is there even such thing as like anything close to a local market or free market or market that has feedback loops that are reasonable in this day and age, in this age of e-commerce and just massive capital flows? Does that even exist? I feel like we're so detached from reality at this point.
Let me maybe finish this up with this analogy, and this is an incomplete, like I'm working this out in my head, so this might come out incomplete. I think if you think of like a forest, you recognize that forests have like large trees, they have small trees, they have brush, they have underbrush, they'll have ferns and lichens and, all the like different, basically you can think of like different intensity of fauna, of flora, excuse me. So you look at that and you realize that there are big players in a forest. There are huge trees. They do take up a huge canopy. They do, steal the sunlight from things that are underneath. I think if you used a well-functioning market to a forest, what you would see, and let's go back to the pre-Great Depression era. I think if you looked at cities, you would see the housing market acting like a local market, where you had some big players, you had a lot of small players, you had a lot of underbrush and a lot of like little things happening all over the place. It's not that you didn't have a segregation of intensity or a segregation of like different people with different wealth levels. You did. But what you would have now, if you said, okay, that is what markets were like in pre-Great Depression era. Now, in the 75 years into the suburban experiment, where everything's been centralized and everything's very top down and you're the product, not the consumer, it's like you have a city with like five sequoias that reach 2,000 feet into the air and then like nothing on the ground, like very, very little else going on in terms of underbrush and understory and small trees. And that's just not a forest. Like that's something else. That's not a market. And you can say the market's happening at 2,000 feet as these five sequoias battle with each other for sunlight, way up in the sky. But that's not a market that's responding to you and me anymore. That's a market that is responding to something else. And I, I'm I'm fine with like the hyper YIMBYs. There's a bunch of different strains of YIMBY, but there's one that's like a libertarian YIMBY. It's like a, you know, dogmatic market. I like get their thinking to a degree. I just think they have the market wrong. They think that the five 2,000 foot sequoias is the market, and it's not. It's actually a distortion of what a natural market would be.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to like let a free market work when everything is so completely distorted. And I agree with you. I understand the arguments and thinking, but there's a lot more that goes into it than like just deregulating zoning, because we have all of these financial products that are also feeding into this and creating different feedback loops that are very much detached from like the people consuming the product of housing.
Yeah. We need to deregulate zoning. We need to do that on steroids. But if you just deregulate zoning and you don't actually deal with this problem, I mean, how do we respond to
this? I always say, just as someone who works in zoning a lot, I picture that there are some people that think if we just deregulate zoning, we're going to have like beautiful cities and everything, you know, all the developers are going to come in and build the cities we want to see, and not like Applebee's everywhere. Like,
you're right. Yeah.
Like we still have a building culture and financial products that spit out things. And sorry to throw Applebee's under the bus.
It's okay.
But you know what I mean?
I wrote a whole article on Cheesecake Factory back during the pandemic. And I said, you don't have a Cheesecake Factory because people love Cheesecake Factories. You have a Cheesecake Factory because we have bailed out Cheesecake Factory in the pandemic.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve bought their debt and made it so that instead of going out of business, they could continue to survive.
I think
this is what we did.
That's a smart move for our economy. We cannot let Cheesecake Factory
go down.
No, absolutely not.
I'm heading to California tomorrow, and I have to admit, I will be going to In-N-Out Burger because it is my favorite. We all have our favorites, right?
Yeah, we all have our favorites. But yeah, deregulating, like, I agree, like, we need to massively change our entire approach to how we regulate city building. But that doesn't mean that we also don't need to be changing our financial systems and our building culture, because all of these builders are not just going to start building, like, beautiful brick three-story buildings that everybody loves. We do have a reality of why things look the way they look, as Colby said, told us about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. Can I preview the book?
Let's do it.
If you're listening to this, there's probably a lot of people thinking, well, we need to redo the entire financial system. And like, I can't do that. Like, I don't know how to do that. Like, what do I do? Like, do I vote for one of the two parties who are both entwined with it? What do I do? And I want to tell you, I don't have an answer for that. And that's not what this whole project is about. But here's the thing. We can localize a lot of the finance around constructing, particularly entry-level units. We can do that at scale. We can do it without cities losing any money doing it. Cities can be, if they want to be, big players in a marketplace that makes housing broadly more affordable. They can do it at scale. They can do it without losing money. They can do it with tools that they have on hand right now today. But they have to be willing to recognize their place in that ecosystem and why they're so important. And I guess that's a preview of the book. Like, if you want more of that, I talk about this in the book. So this is something that we have a plan for. We need cities to step up and be that entity that creates in the market, you know, the understory, so to speak.
You're not calling people together for a revolution to take down the entire financial system.
No, I mean, someone else can do that, and maybe I'd show up, depending perhaps. But I mean, that's not our whole thing. Has always been about how do we empower local people to do things for themselves. And the reality is, we have a lot more power than we think we have, and particularly, we're not powerless against this fiscal insanity. We're really not. We can do things to anchor our own local market in sanity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chuck, we've gone a little long today, but do you want to do the down zone? Do you have time?
Yeah.
All right. So go ahead.
Okay. I was going to talk about like two books that I've been reading.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm going to talk about instead? Right now, as when this comes out, the NBA playoffs will be going on. I'm from Minnesota. I remember when we got our basketball team when I was a young kid. We've had 30 some years. I like basketball, but I have had the worst team in the NBA basically my entire life. We've been good one part of 1 year. Otherwise, we've been historically bad and inept bad. We are really good right now. And we may lose in the first round of the playoffs. We may get, you know, embarrassed. We may become a laughingstock. I don't know. I have had 82 games of basketball that has been some of the most fun basketball ever. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I am really excited about the Minnesota Timberwolves playing in the playoffs. I like our team. I like our attitude. It's very Minnesotan to me. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, baseball is my sport. Like I probably enjoy baseball more than any other, but I do love, love, love basketball. I've just not had much good basketball in my life. And to finally be watching what is really like elite top tier play has been a ton of fun. So thank you to every team that has allowed us to beat you this year. If you want a fun team to follow, Minnesota's got a beautiful young core. They're going to be around many years together. Hopefully, I mean, the NBA is a weird league and players demand trades and all this stuff, but we seem to have really good group with a really good attitude. And I will be awaiting to find out who we play in the first round of the playoffs. And if I'm not traveling, I might even try to go, which would be really
cool. That's awesome. I feel like as somebody who is in Missouri, I grew up in St. Louis. I've been in Kansas City now for, I don't know, what year is it? 12 years, 13 years. We don't really have basketball. I guess there's the KU, K-State. I feel like my perception is so detached from like understanding basketball. I played it a little bit when I was younger, but I don't like people throwing objects at me. So I didn't play it for very long.
Sure.
It just wasn't my sport, like many sports, but especially basketball wasn't my sport. I feel like that's something I've never really gotten into, but people who get into it like love watching basketball.
Yeah. It was my sport, but I was too skinny.
Oh, really?
I mean, I've told you this. I think when I joined the Army, I joined the Army on my 17th birthday. I was 6 foot tall. I had spent the prior 4 months gaining weight, like eating five times a day and doing all this stuff to try to gain weight. I was 6 foot, 123.
Wow.
As the end of my junior year of high school, I was 6 foot, 123. I was tall in the sense that like I grew faster and I was like a decent size to play basketball at the high school level, but I had like no size. So I like couldn't do anything physical when people would start pushing you around on a court, you know, which is what happens when you get a little bit older. But
even,
I don't know.
For young children, Chuck, people.
It is true. No, the bigger players, I was never like, that wasn't my game. But no. you look at the professional game, I got to, it was a couple of decades ago, because my team is so bad, or historically bad, there have been a lot of opportunities to sit close to the action. Usually when I go, I'm a cheap seats person, so I'm up in the upper deck and you're watching. But I had an opportunity once on Martin Luther King Day, and I can't remember what year it was. I think I was in grad school, so it might have been like 01 or 02. I went to a game because they had an afternoon game on a Monday afternoon. Nobody was there. Like, I mean, it was a bad team at a bad time of day, like everything about it. Nobody was there. And I got seats three rows back for like $40. You have not experienced like astounding physical athletes until you sat four rows back at an NBA game. Because these people are massive giants. I mean, they are like they're like massive human beings. Like, you know, like I don't even know how someone has built this scale, this size. This person is huge. And then they run at like sprinter speeds, like at unbelievable speeds. They're moving around. The ball's moving around. The physicalness of the sport is just absolutely mind-blowing. And when I sat that close, it just, it brought home to me. It took something that I really liked and it made it like, oh my gosh. Like,
wow, this is really cool.
Yes. Yes. Even like for my daughters in dance, the cool place to sit and dance is kind of like two thirds of the way up, because you can see all the formations and all the stuff. I hate sitting there. I always like to sit right on the floor. And my wife was like, it's the worst view in the whole place. And I'm like, no, it's the best view, because these are like prime. I mean, for high school kids, they are astounding athletes, especially at like a really high level. They're doing like turns and spins and kicks and all this stuff that like a normal human being can't do. You have to like really work for years to be able to do this stuff. And they're doing it at a high level. They're doing it with a high level of competency. And just to be close to it, you get like this unreal feel. The NBA sitting courtside or near courtside, it just blew my mind. It really did. But you can only do that with a really bad team. I mean, on my with my savings account, you can only do that with a really horrible team on a really bad day to go to a game. Because otherwise, I don't even know what courtside seats would cost. But I think I was two rows behind the bench. It was wild.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah. As a dancer, I totally agree with you on you know, where to sit for watching dancing.
Yeah. But
yeah, that's nobody throws anything at you when you do dance. Just
no.
No one pushes you, no one's throwing things at you.
Well,
low pressure.
We'll go to the shows and they'll do the same. They'll have show all day and there'll be three different versions of it. And I will always take one and sit right up on the floor, and it embarrasses my wife says I'm dumb, yeah. And my kids are embarrassed. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm dad. I'm going to do one. I won't do all three, but I'm going to sit up here by myself for one and watch it.
That's funny. Well, I have a lot of different things that I could share. I think, we're going kind of long on time, but I am reading this book that I think you've brought up before on this show. I can't remember when, but I'm reading The Elephant in the Brain. You are familiar with that book, correct?
Yep.
It's basically a book that is exploring the motives of human behavior and ways in which people basically self-deceive themselves, because a lot of human behavior is ultimately selfish. So according to this book. So it's a really interesting one. I am like maybe five chapters into it, so don't spoil anything for me, but I'm really enjoying the topic and just learning a little bit more about it.
I've talked a lot about thinking fast and slow. The Elephant in the Brain is, and this is no offense to you, is like a Reader's Digest version of Thinking Fast and Slow. It's like a more accessible version. But it gets at a lot of the same insights, and it's a great book. I mean, I would highly recommend it to people. And you said selfish. I don't think that's wrong. But I don't think the book, you know, a lot of it is like we react in ways that our brains are evolutionary design to react.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And maybe selfish in like a bad connotation term is not exactly the right word for it, but it's about protection and self-preservation, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The book goes into all different types of topics, from like art to charity, and how all these different aspects of how humans relate to one another work, and what is really rooted psychologically and how we engage with that.
Well, there's a huge advantage that's been given to humans for those who are very quickly able to assess in-group from out-group in early, early human evolution, right? And that wiring like sticks in our brains. It's one of the reasons why you hear me talk a lot about the fact that we need to create this like bigger circle of empathy. We need to make more people in our in-group, and the more we can bring people in and like identify ways that we all share experiences and share aspirations, the more we can create an in-group that is very, very big, the more we recognize the humanity in each other. But it does, your brain does try to trick you, right? Your brain does. You are a complex human who has inherited thousands of years of default settings from humans who survived much, much harsher conditions than we will ever experience. And if you recognize that and like respect it, you see that it gives you certain superpowers as a human, and it also gives you like all these weaknesses. And that I think the elephant in the brain is, you know, and thinking fast and slow, it's like peels it back, because the human brain is this like massive gift. It is this beautiful thing, but it also has like these default settings that you can understand how they became, but they're not always, if you started humans from scratch, they're not the default settings you would want to program in.
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks, Chuck. This has been fun talk, and I'm looking forward to, I guess, the next time. I don't think that we are planning to do this next week. So the next time we may talk, maybe in Cincinnati.
Actually, the book is out.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I'm going to Spain. So.
Oh, yeah, you are.
I am.
Oh, so, okay. Well, we will, if we don't talk before, we will talk in Cincinnati at the National Gathering.
Yes.
Have fun in Spain.
Thank you.
And yeah.
All right. Thanks, Chuck. And thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you. Take care.